Borders uphold a global system of apartheid, and we should demand nothing less than their abolition. In this interview, activist and writer Harsha Walia lays out how borders and citizenship maintain colonial axes of power. From Fortress Europe, outsourcing border control into the African continent in exchange for aid, to Canada securing the availability of cheap farm workers through its selective migration system, she demonstrates how capitalism and border regimes feed off each other. Harsha Walia makes a compelling case for abolition. No banks, no bombs, no borders, no bosses. Or, in her own words, why would we fight for anything less than the freedom of all people? At the State of Power podcast, we're glad to once again host Harsha, who is an activist and writer based in Canada. Her books include Border and Rule, Global Migration, Capitalism, and the Rise of Racist Nationalism, published in 2021, and Undoing Border Imperialism, published in 2013. Here she is in conversation with Arun Kundnani, a TNI associate and author of The Muslims Are Coming, Islamophobia, Extremism, and the Domestic War on Terror.
Hello, and welcome to another interview from the Transnational Institute. In this series of conversations, we meet people who can lay out a different vision of what global security should look like in an era of pandemics and climate breakdown. In this installment, I met with Harsha Walia. We talked about how borders uphold a global system of apartheid, how that system has functioned during the period of the COVID pandemic, and why we should demand nothing less than the abolition of borders. Harsha, thank you for joining us today. I want to begin by talking about something you wrote recently in an article in the Boston Review. And you wrote that borders maintain hoarded concentrations of wealth accrued from colonial domination while ensuring mobility for some and containment for most, a system of global apartheid determining who can live where and under what conditions. So I found that really useful to kind of start us off thinking about some of the issues we're going to be talking about today. So can you kind of help us understand a little about what you're thinking there?
Thanks, Aaron. Thanks for having me. I think one of the things around borders is they become so naturalized in our consciousness, right? We understand them to be a product of natural law, almost as if the way this is how the world was always organized. But I think thinking about borders as a system of control, like any other system of control, whether that's police or prisons or racism, you know, citizenship is a key tool of maintaining power. And one of the many axes of power that exists in the world today is the differentiation between the citizen and the non-citizen. And specifically, maintaining citizenship in the rich parts of the world, in settler colonial states like where I reside in Canada, in Europe, is to maintain a colonial access of power. And one of the ways to maintain the wealth accrued by colonialism and imperialism and empire over the past many centuries is to use citizenship as a tool of a gated community, right? To maintain those centers of power and the privileges accrued with it, the material benefits that accrue from that wealth is through citizenship, by literally denying people the right to live in certain parts of the world. And so borders are, you know, if you think about it, you know, depending on where you were born, for the vast majority of people in the world, where you were born and the passport you carry determines your life. It determines your life expectancy. It determines your access to food, to water, to shelter, to health. And so that's what borders are. They literally determine who can live where and under what conditions.
Yeah. And it'd be interesting to talk a bit about how that structure of control, that global apartheid structure that you've just been talking about, how that functioned during the COVID-19 period. So in broad terms, like, what does that look like?
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the things that COVID-19 did and continues to do, because of course the health emergency continues, we live in an era of now vaccine apartheid that is layered atop global apartheid, as we know. you know, one of the things that it did, which all previous other emergencies have also done, you know, 9/11, all of these global emergencies become a pretext to securitize the border. And with COVID, restrictions on movement provided an additional language to justify the restriction of movement. You know, so during the height of the pandemic in 2020, even though the WHO, you know, despite all of its flaws, you know, never actually mandated for countries to shut down borders. There was no correlation between the movement of people across borders and the COVID pandemic. You know, if anything, the rise in the pandemic was around density and social distancing and, of course, you know, structural measures that people needed to stay safe, but it had nothing to do with the movement of people, particularly asylum seekers who are fleeing for safety, right? Whose movement is essential, is as essential as an essential service, arguably. But over 100 countries during the pandemic, primarily European and Northern countries, shut down, not exclusively, but primarily shut down their borders to people on the move, particularly asylum seekers and refugees. And so, of course, this created a massive crisis for people in terms of their safety. In the United States, you had things like Title 42, immediate expulsions at the border, justified under the rubric of health and safety. And this was paralleled across the world. You know, in France, makeshift camps and border areas of primarily African and Middle Eastern migrants and refugees who were trying to get in, you know, atop the already existing crisis of the Mediterranean. And so, you know, the COVID pandemic really escalated the crisis of immobility for immigrants and refugees seeking safety. At the same time, what the COVID pandemic revealed is what the border has always done, which is a selective inclusion, right? So those who were migrant workers were actually allowed in. So in Canada and the United States, for example, and also elsewhere, migrant workers who are working the farms and fields of these countries were actually brought in en masse to ensure that food supply chains were not affected, right? So the movement of asylum seekers was undesirable, but migrants who could be commodified in the context of, you know, capitalism continuing business as is, capitalism continuing unabated, capitalism requiring cheapened labor, the border continued to provide that cheapened labor, right? That spatial fix that the border provides to cheapen labor. And so migrant workers were brought in en masse. Their labor exploited, of course, their health and safety not at all considered. In Canada, where I live, one of the major hotspots, not a coincidence, alongside homeless encampments, alongside prisons, was migrant worker camps, right? Because the safety of migrant workers was disregarded. You're forced to work, you're forced to live in close proximity, you're forced to work in already dangerous conditions, and then, of course, COVID on top of that. So the kind of flights bringing in migrant workers continued. And at the same time, deportation flights expelling deportees out also continued. You know, there was at one point in the pandemic where Guatemalan and Honduran officials said that at least a quarter of the cases of COVID in their countries, particularly in Central America, were a result of American flights deporting people back to Honduras and Guatemala, right? Like that they were COVID cases that were traced back to deportation flights. So the COVID pandemic really exposed these already existing fault lines of how certain movement, you know, whether it's the movement of deportees, whether it's the movement of migrant workers, exists parallel to the shutdown border for asylum seekers, irregular migrants.
Yeah, and I remember sort of in the early months of the pandemic in 2020, people were talking about how, you know, people were making predictions, especially in the United States with Donald Trump in the White House, that, you know, that this would, that the pandemic would provide a kind of pretext for all kinds of repressive powers in the name of, you know, a kind of health emergency. And then people were like, oh, wow, actually that didn't happen. But it did happen for you know, particular groups of people, like you've been saying, like asylum seekers. And of course, you know, the kind of you know, the sort of idea that there was any kind of health imperative driving that is obviously flimsy. I mean, you just, you know, not apart from the examples you already gave, you know, that if you were really just thinking about it from a health point of view, you wouldn't be cramming migrants inside immigration detention centers. You would be stopping the private jets from flying around the world as much as you would be trying to stop asylum seekers. So, you know, and of course people in private jets were, you know, were never affected by travel bans or any other restrictions. So, you know, absolutely, I think that's very, that becomes very visible. And so I guess picking up on the point of migrant workers that you were just speaking about, can you talk a little more about how, you know, I think one of the striking things about COVID was how it did seem to make visible some of these structures that shape our lives, particularly around, you know, what people ended up calling essential workers, many of whom were migrant workers. So can you say a bit more about what that looked like? Like, was there this kind of consciousness raising effect, do you think? And did that translate into, you know, more political kind of support and solidarity for people in those situations?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, for migrant workers, it was very similar to a lot of low-wage workers, where in the beginning of the pandemic, there was this brief moment, but really not one that we could say was really as much about solidarity, but if anything, it's about, you know, charity and generosity, where state officials and the elite kind of shower this gratitude to essential workers, right? To service workers, to grocery workers, to healthcare workers, and, you know, for the first time, not just doctors, but, you know, appropriate acknowledgement of the healthcare system as including nurses and janitors and lab techs, you know, like the ecosystem of healthcare beyond the kind of professional elite. But that moment was fleeting, and we know that it was for the purposes of maintaining neoliberalism, right? So, kind of having this acknowledgement as a way of saying they are keeping the economy going, but of course we're doing nothing substantive to ensure these workers' well-being, whether it's their working conditions or whether it's their wages, and everything around that. And so for migrant workers, that was a big part of it, where there was a brief period of time where there was a recognition that migrant workers drive the essential parts of the economy. Again, whether it's farm workers, grocery chain workers, service retail workers, the entire gig economy that exploded during the pandemic, you know, delivery driving, et cetera. But there was nothing substantive that emerged from it in terms of actually materializing the demands of migrant worker movements, which is for labor rights, for labor protections, immigration status, an end to deportations, an end to deaths on the farms. Again, you know, some of the major hotspots, as I was mentioning, were migrant farm camps, but, you know, nothing substantively changed in terms of that. So I think there was a moment of recognition of who drives our economy, but it was to maintain neoliberalism and the facade of care without substantively changing anything. But I think what has shifted is perhaps, you know, is people's consciousness, right? So we see with Amazon strikes, the level of support that these new labor movements have, particularly new labor movements that are genuinely multiracial, that are led by feminist leadership, that are led by migrants, Black and brown folks. So I think the level of support that they have, not from the elite, of course, but from people who realize that we live in such a stratified world, right, where some of us can literally stay home and our entire well-being means that other people are sacrifice zones, right? Like not the earth is a sacrifice zone and humans are sacrificing their lives for us. I think people have had to sit with that in starker ways. And so I think that consciousness has shifted. And there is, I think, much more solidarity for labor movements now than there was even a few decades ago, right?
And so you mentioned the earth as a sacrifice zone as well. So what, you know, one of the major drivers of displacement, I think, today is the heating of the planet, and which of course itself is caused by the, you know, the pursuit of profit for elites at the expense of everything else. What is, you know, what is the kind of response that we're seeing from governments in the richer countries who are looking at this increasing displacement due to climate crisis?
Yeah, I mean, what we see from the elite, when it comes to climate displacement, really mirrors the response of the elite when it comes to climate change in general. You know, so 20 years ago, we had the elite, you know, liberal elite completely denying climate change. We're in a time now where they're not completely denying climate change. I mean, some right-wing politicians are, but you know, that the climate is something that is on the tip of most people's tongues now, including politicians and liberal politicians. But their solutions to climate change in general is more neoliberalism, right? Whether that's techno-solutionism or greenwashing or carbon markets or Teslas, you know, and, you know, more mining in the Congo, you know, those are the solutions, green technologies that the liberals give us, rather than, as we know, eliminating capitalism as the economic order that we live in, right? Which is what we actually need, and an end to colonialism and global reparations and redistribution. So that's not the solution presented to climate change by the world order when it comes to, you know, the World Bank, the IMF, and state officials, the EU, et cetera. And so that same kind of response is what we see when it comes to climate displacement, which is, as you mentioned, one of the fastest growing forms of human displacement on the planet now, both within and across borders. You know, it's not only across borders, it's also within borders in terms of how it's completely changed the topography and ecosystems of entire societies. And the response from most state governments is more border securitization, right? Mm-hmm. So it becomes climate refugees becomes the new kind of nascent scapegoat, you know? So it used to be, I mean, continues to be the terrorist, the criminal, the illegal, the swarm, all of these dehumanizing stereotypes. And now we have the climate refugee added to that. Mm-hmm. And so eco-fascism has really relied on the threat of the climate refugee as the new kind of border threat. And states have mobilized this threat. So, you know, eco-fascist movements are far-right movements, but states have really reproduced this logic. Countries like the United States and Australia and states across the EU have set up entire units of immigration enforcement, naval teams that are completely and entirely simply committed to stopping and interdicting boats carrying climate refugees or those who have displaced from climate disasters in the aftermath of climate disasters. The United States, for example, after a number of climate disasters in the Caribbean, basically blasted out messages that no one should leave those countries in the Caribbean, including Haiti. And, you know, those are the kinds of militaristic responses to climate displacement that we are getting from states and formations like the EU, where the response to climate disasters and climate displacement is, on the one hand, again, to not actually address climate change. And then on the second hand, to actually continue to criminalize and immobilize people who are on the move as a result of climate disasters. And of course, those are already people, as you've mentioned, you know, where climate is layered on top of existing dynamics such as enforced poverty, free trade agreements, you know, imperial flows of capital, extraction, et cetera. And so climate-induced displacement exists on top of already existing catastrophes and disasters, and people are just mm-hmm. dealing with more and more militarism.
Mm-hmm. And of course, the injustice of it is all the more striking because the people's most likely to be forced to leave their homes as a result of climate crisis are the ones, you know, in those parts of the world that have done yeah. the least to contribute to the amount of carbon in the atmosphere, right? So it's it, you know, the hypocrisy of it is all the more extreme for that reason. Mm-hmm. One of the things that we're also seeing at the moment is governments in the richer countries kind of refashioning the architecture of borders so that they are involved in something called externalization, where we kind of push the borders, outsource the borders to other parts of the world. Can you talk about what's involved in that and what its consequences are?
Yeah, thanks for that. And, you know, TNI has done some of the most important work on the externalization of borders globally. And for me, I think it's just so urgent because so much of how we have fought borders is kind of a nationalist response in itself, right? Like we fight the border where it exists as this kind of line on the map. So, you know, in the US context, for example, people fight the border wall. People fight deportations in the United States, you know, the so-called territory of the United States, occupied indigenous lands. But really, the border exists far beyond the territorial boundaries of nation states, and increasingly so, really perfected by the EU and Australia, who have had an externalized regime of border control for decades. You know, in the Australian case, offshore detention centers in Nauru and Papua New Guinea and elsewhere have been going on since the 1990s. But really what externalization of the border is, you know, countries enforcing their immigration policies and their desires to stem immigration, particularly irregular immigration, far beyond the territorial border, right? So trying to stop immigration at the as close to the source as possible. That's the logic. And so in the case of the EU, we know, for example, that, you know, Fortress Europe actually starts well beyond the borders of Europe. Itself a fiction, as we know, but, you know, extends well into the African continent, extends well into Southwestern Asia. You know, the horrors that are unfolding in Libya right now are a function of murderous EU policies, right, where the EU has long worked with Libyan state officials and paramilitaries to enforce the halting of migrants well before they reach the EU. EU policies in Turkey to stop migration from Syria coming through Turkey. We have an entire regime of the EU where almost every single trade and aid agreement that the EU makes with particularly African countries in the Sahel region requires African countries to institute a regime of migration prevention. So whether that is criminalizing smuggling, whether that is participating in migration detention, whether that is actual boots on the ground that trains African forces to stop migration, you know, so there, this is a literal requirement of most African states in the Sahel region before they can even enter into a trade agreement or an aid agreement with the EU. And this is also true in the United States, where a number of trade agreements and any bilateral agreement or multilateral agreement between the United States and Mexico or between countries in Central America requires these countries to adopt migration prevention measures. And so here we see a number of things at play. You know, we see, of course, the globalizing of immigration controls, where countries that were previously deemed source countries are now also implicated in migration detention prevention and border militarism. We see how this affects the geopolitics within regions. So Mexico, for example, now deports more Central American migrants than the United States does, because migrants who are coming through Mexico to get to the United States never even make it to the US now, because they are being violently expelled from Mexico. And the third thing is that, of course, we see the maintenance of an imperial present. You know, there's a lot of debate in the world today about whether imperialism, particularly in the left, not the world, the left world, about whether imperialism is still a useful mode of analysis. And, you know, I would argue, and others would argue, I think, that looking at the way in which immigration diplomacy is playing out in the world very clearly delineates the maintenance of imperialism and how imperial powers are able to use immigration and immigration policy and immigration diplomacy as a way to maintain imperial relations, right? So that we already know that trade agreements and aid agreements maintain our legacy of imperialism. And I would add that immigration diplomacy is a new pillar through which we can understand how imperial relations are maintained and outsourced to the from the core to the periphery, right?
Mm-hmm, absolutely. So in thinking about borders, you take an abolitionist approach, I think, which is somewhat different from maybe thinking about borders in a way where, you know, we might advocate for reforms to how borders work so that people are treated more humanely, perhaps, or something like that. Can you talk about what abolitionism means in respect to borders and why that makes most political sense to you as a organizer?
Yeah, I mean, to me, there was always a corollary between arguing for, no banks, no bombs, no borders, no bosses. Like that was a slogan of organizing that I was around for a very, very long time. And to me, those are congruent ideas, right? That we understand that capitalism, or Arun, as you and so many others have done such an immense job in articulating for us racial capitalism and empire, that these are congruent systems that feed off of each other. And so right now, in a time of the resurgence of abolitionist thinking led by the Black radical tradition and Black abolitionists, to me, the idea of no borders similarly sits in the ideas of, why we can't reform policing, prisons, the military, et cetera, because these systems function exactly as they were designed to. Prisons don't not work because they need to be tweaked. They work exactly as they were meant to, which is that they're a system of social control and enslavement. And in order to maintain racial capitalism, to discipline surplus populations, right? Ruthie Wilson Gilmore teaches us that. And so similarly for me, borders, I think people struggle with borders more because I think we are trapped in some way in nationalist thinking, even in our movements. And because there's just such a deeply ingrained idea of us, whoever the us is, that mimics that nationalist thinking. But to me, like all kind of all ordering regimes, whatever ways in which social ordering is maintained through ideas of bordering, right? Of ideas of us versus them, of ways that see us, that believes in race theory, that believes in, transphobia. All of these kinds of flawed ways, deeply oppressive ways of thinking, have at their core the same logic of borders. And so when I think about no borders, the one thing that I will say though is that I do think it's different than open borders. So, there on the one hand, there's people who want to reform borders, which, I don't think will work because borders maintain a deathscape. And going back to, the earlier piece of this conversation, as long as borders exist in our contemporary world, they will continue to literally define who lives where, under what conditions. Like it literally determines how well you live. But also open borders, which some in social movements argue for, I think is also limited because what open borders do is they still, it's the idea of opening the border to migrants, but maintaining all the other social hierarchies and differentiations in the world, right? So open borders is not enough if we are still going to maintain plunder and extraction, and ravage the earth and ravage communities, because then of course, we're ensuring that people can move safely, but we are not ensuring that people do not have to move if they don't want to, right? We also don't want to live in a world where people are forcibly displaced from their homes and their lands and their communities because of cycles of violence. And so, no borders, as it sits within an abolitionist politic, is very similar to how abolitionists argue that, Dr. Angela Davis, Dr. Ruthie Gilmore, Mariam Kaba, and so many others have articulated that prison abolition is not simply getting rid of prisons. It's also radically transforming the social conditions that give rise to prisons as a solution in the first place, right? To radically transform social conditions of enforced poverty, of gender-based violence, of transphobia, of racial capitalism, of empire, et cetera. And so to say no borders is also to argue similarly that we have to be able to live in a world where no one is forcibly displaced, and we have to be able to live in a world where people are able to move freely. So for me, that vision of no borders is part of an abolitionist tradition. And the last thing that I'll say is that, of course, we have to recognize and deeply understand that the criminalization of migration itself flows from the criminalization of Blackness, right? And that anti-Blackness, as a form of social control, has always been about punishing Black mobility. And so, in that sense, there's also so much to say and to learn from the Black radical tradition about how the criminalization of migration is part and part, and arguably at the forefront of struggle, of abolitionist struggle. And of course, we see that in very obvious terms today when we see who is most likely to be criminalized, who is most likely to be immobilized. Are primarily Black Muslim migrants on this planet.
Thank you. Yeah. Where do you see movements emerging today to abolish borders? What are the places where we can look to for that kind of movement?
I think everywhere. I think everywhere, you know, and I think like all social movements, those are the most radical, those that are often smaller, right? Because of course, by their very nature, they're least likely to get public attention. They're least likely to get fancy funding. You know, they're least likely to have the kind of star power that flashy campaigns have that are more liberal. But there is not a place on this planet where no borders movements that are radical and abolitionist in tradition don't exist. And, you know, I'd be remiss to say that, of course, many of them that are the most clear in their articulations are in the context of the global South, right? It's not just in the global North where people are fighting back against our government's policies. It's also social movements in the so-called global South that are articulating what freedom of movement means, how freedom of movement is a form of decolonial reparations. And so there are, you know, depending on where people are located, they can find abolitionist no border movements who are arguing for no borders in their own terms, in their own languages, in their own visions, but are essentially questioning and challenging the legitimacy of borders at its core. And really some of the strongest movements right now because of the crisis of migration at the EU borders. And, you know, the past few months have been horrific, have been absolutely horrific, both in terms of EU policies and the rise of particularly far right governments, you know, in Italy in particular, social movements in the Sahel region, social movements in Syria, social movements in Pakistan, social movements in Afghanistan, who have really been fighting for freedom of movement, who have been articulating the horrors of migration, who are implicating, you know, imperialism in all its forms, who are implicating, you know, dictatorships and authoritarian regimes, who are really refusing to succumb to any matrix of power, and who are, you know, so strongly articulating migration as freedom, like as a form of freedom struggle. And borders as a regime of social control are so strong right now. So that's, you know, one specific place. In Australia, former detainees have some of the strongest demands when it comes to abolishing the border, and also calling for boycotts. There's a boycott right now that RISE has been calling for and really calling on social movements to refuse complicity with bordering regimes. But, you know, really there are so many. And so, I think it's important to seek them out because it can be very easy to get drowned out in the kind of liberal narrative of border reform. Mm-hmm. And it's so important that we amplify radical movements and who really, you know, often get written off as utopic. But, you know, I've always, like for me, it feels so clear that reform is a continued deathscape. Like why? Mm-hmm. Why would we fight for anything less than freedom for all people? It's our imperative to do that, right? So supporting those movements is so important.
Thank you, Hersha. That was really amazing. And there's so many insights there. So thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
You're listening to the State of Power podcast from the Transnational Institute. This was a conversation between TNI associate Arun Kundanani and Hersha Walia, an activist and writer based in Canada. Be sure to also check out previous episodes in this series and to look out for upcoming ones. TNI's material is all free, but we would greatly appreciate your help to keep doing the work we do. One of the ways you can help out is simply to rate our podcast on whichever platform you're listening from. And please write us a review. This will only help us to get better at what we do. If you'd like to find out more about how you can boost TNI's work, please click on the Support TNI tab on our website, tni.org. If you have specific questions, requests, or suggestions for the podcast, please send an email to podcast@tni.org. You can also find us on social media at Transnational Institute on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. Thank you for joining us, and be sure to tune in next time.